So with that, call forward Mr. Peter Lawrence.
Well, thank you for that reading, Chase. You did a fantastic job, so that's good. I wanted to have that reading read essentially as a contrast. Now, we live in a remarkable world, which is full of man's marvels. This laptop, which I have here, is quite a marvel of technology and all that it can do. This furniture, this building, the infrastructure, the roads, everything which we see around us, the technology, the gadgets, the feats of engineering, the unimaginable displays of wealth are around us every day. And they press upon us and they're in our face. And so I wanted to draw a strong contrast between that world and the world of God, the world which he has created. And I think that chapter does a fantastic job. And it's easy for us to be mesmerized and distracted and caught up in all the glitz and the glamour and the gadgetry of this world which we live in. But I think it's more than important that we take the time to consider the wonders of God's creation, the things that God has made. So what I'd like to talk about today, we'll talk about a few things, but the first thing I'd like to talk about is the human hand. I think we all have two of them here. And the human hand is arguably the most remarkable piece of engineering and design in the universe, second only to the hand of God. But our hands are absolutely astonishing when we take a moment to sit down and consider. And we're going to take a moment and we're going to actually labor this point and just think about our hands. We have them, they're right in front of us. I can almost guarantee that until you hit your thumb with a hammer, you basically take them for granted. So, a couple of things about our hands. First of all, they are in front of us, which might seem painfully obvious, and it is painfully obvious, but that's a critical design element that our hands are in front of us, they're not behind us. They are in perfect view of our eyes. We can see what we do with our hands, which is very, very important. Our hands are separated from our body with our arms. We don't have like little T-Rex hands to do things with. They're out in front of us, so we can do things separate and at a distance from the rest of our body. Our hands can display incredible power, like a knockout punch with incredible force. Not that I encourage that here, but the fact is it's possible with our hands if we clench them into a fist or any other karate moves. While also being able to deliver the most gentle of caress to, say, a child or a loved one. Our hands can catch things. Our hands can throw things and throw and catch different things. The motion of throwing a dart is very different from throwing a football or a baseball or a frisbee. And yet our hands can manage to, with the dexterity, to do all those things. And if we just think about it for a moment, if a ball comes, and presuming it's not coming at 100 miles an hour, we're able to track it with our eyes, and the signals go through, and we can move our hand to where it's going to come, and it doesn't just hit, well, sometimes maybe it just hits and drops, but we can actually catch that ball. And it's amazing. We can catch a frisbee. We can catch different sized, shaped things. We have the ability to do this with our hands. It's amazing. We're able to, not me personally, someone like Tiger Woods is able to take a stick far away from not only his body, but also his hands. And he can swing the end of that stick, which may be a meter away from his hands, with such incredible precision to strike a tiny ball and make that tiny ball in turn do incredible things with the spin and the control and the minutia of movements within our hands to be able to control a stick or a baseball bat or something like that or a hockey stick. To use a tool in that way is absolutely incredible. Our hands can wield the power of a hammer to forge red hot iron into something And our hands can also carve the Eiffel Tower in a pencil lead, which we can't even imagine the detail that it takes to do something like that. I've seen videos. The guy has a crazy microscope. He's actually taken breathing lessons so he can slow his pulse and his heart rate down. And he's got the tiniest of tools. And through the microscope, looking at literally a pencil lead, he's able to carve sculptures in the most tiny, tiny medium. So the range of control of power that is able to be used and wielded in the hand is absolutely incredible. But not only can it do things and manipulate things, the hand can sense when something is hot and also can sense when something is cold. You can feel textures. I can feel the texture of this mat or this or my shirt, or I can tell if something is silk or if it's sandpaper. The difference in texture is able to, we're able to understand that. We're able to feel that and learn about our environment through touch, through our hands. With our hands, we can do something so fine as threading a needle, or we can tie a knot. We can hold a cup delicately with our pinky out. You know, we can hold an egg, a delicate egg, or things like that. We can use our hands to communicate. We can do lots of gestures, and hopefully we get more of this tonight and less of this. We can communicate with whole languages, with sign language, by using our hands. Think of the grace of a dancer, of a ballet dancer. I'm going to be terrible at it, but they can just, the way they move their hands is just, it conveys such beauty and grace all through the hands. Our hands can play an instrument like the piano, but more than that, it can convey such power and emotion that's not just mechanical, with the incredible subtleties of touch and pressure on those keys. You can almost bring someone to tears with the power of the delicate motion of the hands, the light touch on a piano. And with your hands, you can unscrew the bolt on the backside of an engine and manipulate your hands in the most awkward positions and still have the dexterity to do something like that. There is nothing in all of nature like the human hand that is so adeptly capable of precision and power, of flexibility and of strength. It's absolutely a miracle of design. No other species on earth possesses anything even remotely capable of what we have in our hands. We think of primates, which have something, appendages which are similar to ours, but nowhere near as capable as what we have. Orangutans have huge hands, much, much larger than ours. But if you look at your hand, an orangutan's fingers are basically all middle fingers. They're long and straight, and the strength, which is considerable in an orangutan's hand, is in one direction. They can grab and hold, which is perfect for swinging on trees, but it can't do much else. So if you look at our hands spread wide, which is amazing. So we have opposable thumbs, which primates do to a point, but primates' thumbs are too small. They're not too small. They're perfectly designed for what primates need to do, but compared to our hand, their thumbs are much shorter in relation to their fingers, and they don't have pinkies like we do. So our hands can grip in this direction, but our hands can also grip in this direction, which primates can't, which is incredible for the dexterity and the things that we can do with our hands. As I said, no other species on earth has anything even remotely close to the capability which God has given to us with our hands. We can manipulate essentially everything in our natural world with our hands and with tools, and we can create the tools with our hands to further manipulate everything around us. One of the earliest and most fascinating discussions of this adaptive marvel was given by the first century Greek physician Galen. And I'll just read a quote here. So this is from the first century. This is like 2,000 years ago. To man, the only animal that partakes in the divine intelligence, The Creator has given, in lieu of every other natural weapon or organ of defense, that instrument, the hand. You know, we don't have claws or incredible teeth or anything like, or, you know, armor on our backs or anything like that, but we do have the hands, and this is what he notices. Applicable to every art and occasion. Let us then scrutinize this member of our body and inquire not simply whether it be itself useful for all the purposes of life and adapted to an animal endowed with the highest intelligence, but whether its entire structure be not such that it could not be improved by any conceivable alteration. He says the hand is flawless. It is perfect. The design of the hand could not be improved in any way. Is the observation of this first century Greek physician. So he then proceeds for several pages to detail the genius of the human hand. And at one point he declares, whoever admires not the skill and contrivance of nature, says, if you don't appreciate this, you must either be deficient in intellect, you're dumb, or you must have some private motive which withholds, which holds this person from expressing his admiration. Says you're either lying, you got some ulterior motive, or you're just incapable, you're not smart enough to appreciate it, is what he says about the hand. He says he must be deficient in intellect if he does not perceive that the human hand possesses all those qualifications which it is desirable it should possess, or if he thinks it might have had formed, had a form and construction preferable to that which it has. So this is his observation. He says it's the most amazing, amazing piece of design in the universe, was his take. So we have a couple of verses, Deuteronomy 32, verse 39. I'm going to just read them, but I'll say where they are in case you're taking notes or for those online. Deuteronomy 32, so this is in the context of the end of the wandering of the children of Israel before they enter the land. Deuteronomy 32, verse 39, see now that I, even I, am he, and there is no God beside me. I kill and I make alive, I wound and I heal, and there is none that can deliver out of my hand. So the power of the hand of God is absolute. There's nothing that can deliver out of the hand of God, and with his hand, he can do everything. Psalm 119, verse 73 was a favorite memory verse when I was younger because it was nice and short. Just the first half of the verse, actually, thy hands hath made me and fashioned me, was David's pondering, David's meditation when he considered God. It was God's hands that had made him and fashioned me. I think the verse continues, give me understanding so that I may know thy commandments. And Isaiah 64 and verse 8 says, but now, O Lord, you are our Father. We are the clay and you are our potter. We are all the work of your hand. And so Isaiah, as well as David, both recognize the fact that we are made by the hand of God. So this is something we you know, talked about. We can observe, we can appreciate our hands. But in order for us to be able to use our hands, we need energy. And so we're going to back up a little bit. So it's one thing to be able to sit down and appreciate the hands which are right in front of our face, but they don't act alone as agents. We need a body. We need energy to be able to vitalize the body in order to be able to actually use these hands that God has given to us. And in our reading, Psalm 104, God links food and hands together. I think in a couple of verses, I should have written this down instead of trying to scan through. There's a verse that talks about God, verse 14, God causes the grass to grow for livestock and plants for man to cultivate that he may bring forth the food of the earth. And then a little further down, he talks about creating things with his hands. Maybe someone can remember or turn that up. So we're going to just shift gears a little bit and talk about how we actually get the energy to even use these hands at the end of our arms, the miracles at the end of our arms. And it's through a process known as oxidation, or if you're in England, I think it's oxidization. Now, everything we've talked about so far has been through a very narrow lens, about this big, just looking at our hands. But we need to step back. We need to step back and get a macro view of what's going on. Because our hands are, of course, part of a much, much larger system. And as we'll see, a system that is so large and so complex that it's absolutely staggering. So we're only going to be able to explore one tiny part of this. I don't have a science degree. I'm not a molecular or chemical biologist. So this is a bit out of my realm of understanding, but we'll just break this down if we can into a pretty small workable frame of reference. So as we consider our hands, it's worthy to also consider God's hands and the work of God's hands. And when we consider the universe, when we consider the world, when we consider, in fact, us that he has made, the work of God's hands is absolutely astonishing. Job comments in Job chapter 11, verses 7, 8, and 9. He says, "Can you find out the deep things of God? Can you find out the limit of the Almighty? It is higher than heaven. What can you do? It is deeper than Sheol. What can you know? Its measure is longer than the earth and broader than the sea." So this is Job's musings on the concept and the scope of God and his wisdom and the work of his hands. David in Psalm 139, verse 6, he says, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's high. I cannot attain unto it. And Proverbs 30, verses 1 to 4, the words of Agar, the son of Jacob, the oracle, the man declares, "I am weary, O God, I am weary, O God, and worn out. Surely I am too stupid to be a man. I have not the understanding of a man. I have not learned wisdom, nor have I the knowledge of the Holy One. Who has ascended to heaven and come down? Who has gathered the winds in his fists? Who has wrapped up the waters in a garment? Who has established all the ends of the earth? What is his name and what is his son's name? Surely you know." So again, in the context of the greatness and the majesty of God, these men recognize their utter irrelevance in comparison to the might and the power of God. So as we mentioned then, before we can even think of performing any of the amazing and remarkable tasks that are possible with hands, we first need energy. And as I started to read through this process of oxidation and the way that we get our energy into our bodies, I realized this is quite a bit above my pay grade. There are so many intricate and detailed steps involved, and there's so many processes which run parallel in order to get from sandwich to energy. We're only going to be able to look at this with a very broad brush. People spend years at university and get degrees and so on to understand all the ins and outs of the processes of what happens to go from food to energy. We don't have the time, and I'm not smart enough. There's a reason that I push a button for a living. So to make this extremely complicated and complex story short and simple, once we eat the food and it's broken down in our stomach and gets into our cells, we have excited oxygen atoms which break down glucose molecules which we get from our food. Glucose is made up of oxygen, hydrogen, and carbon atoms all together. And in this process, we get three things. We get ATP. Well, we get a number of things. We get ATP, which is the actual molecule that we use as energy. And we have a byproduct of CO2. And H2O. Does anybody know what CO2 and H2O is? Carbon dioxide and water. Perfect. So by this process of oxygen breaking down the glucose molecules, and there's, you know, as I say, this is a very, very broad brush, very simplified version of it. We get the actual energy, the molecules which are used for the actual energy, which is ATP, and a byproduct, carbon dioxide and water. Now, what's fortunate is that this reaction is, it takes some added transitional metals in order for this to happen, because this reaction actually also happens in a campfire, where excited oxygen atoms break down the hydrocarbons in the wood, and we get heat, carbon dioxide, and H2O. But that reaction is out of control, and that's why a fire burns, and you get forest fires and tremendous damage. But inside the body, the same reaction occurs to get energy, but it's very controlled, which in itself is also quite miraculous that we get this same process. And our minds can go to things of, you know, verses where God talks about himself being a consuming fire. I think that's interesting, but that's a bit of a tangent. So this reaction happens very controlled and very orderly within the body, not so much with forest fire. So when we breathe out, we get rid of some of the car, we get rid of the carbon dioxide and some of the water. And in a coincidence, which I'll use in brackets, also some of the excess water, the H2O, is released through our skin. And it just happens to cool us down when we use lots of energy. So again, this is just an absolutely amazing design feature that God has built into us. There's just way too many things in order that there's no chance that this can be a coincidence. There's no chance that this can just happen. There is design at every step of the way. So again, now we're going to step back even a little bit further. Where do we get this oxygen and glucose? Because these things are critical for us to have the energy to be even able to move our hands at all. So we can just, you know, much of what the world does with their evolution studies is they already start with all these things in place, and then they kind of analyze how they may change. But we've got to back up further. How do we even get the oxygen and the glucose in the first place to even be having this conversation about energy and moving these amazing miracles that we have at the end of our arms? Well, it turns out that God has given us plenty of oxygen and glucose in his creation. Does anybody have any ideas of where we get lots of oxygen and lots of glucose from? Plants. We need plants. Plants are absolutely critical in order to get oxygen. And it turns out that through photosynthesis, the carbon compounds, glucose, are stored within the plant, which is where we need energy, which is why we eat the plants and why God said to Adam and Eve that he had given them every green herb of the field for food, because this is critical and essential for them to get the energy in order to use the bodies which he had created for them. Genesis 1, verse 29 and 30, God said, "Behold, I have given every plant yielding seed that is on the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit, you shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given the green plant for food." And it was so. So this is remarkable. Not only do we have this amazing miracle of design, but also a method to energize it, to be able to use it. And from our reading tonight, Psalm 104, verse 14, "You cause the grass to grow for the livestock and plants for man to cultivate, that he may bring forth food from the earth." So this process of plants turning sunlight and water into oxygen and glucose molecules, which we need, it's called photosynthesis. They combine carbon dioxide in the atmosphere with sunlight and produce oxygen and glucose in this reaction. So the oxygen is released by the plant into the air, which then we can breathe. And the glucose is stored in the cells in the plant. And when we eat the plant, we get the glucose. We have the oxygen. We have the glucose. We have the energy. We can use our hands. Again, I'm sorry. This is a very simple process. This is about as complex as my brain works. But this is essentially what happens. And now we step back even further and we get to one of the most remarkable things in all of the universe. And we need to talk about light. We need to talk about visible light, the light that we can see, the electromagnetic, the portion of the tiny fraction of the electromagnetic spectrum, which is visible light. And I'm going to do a little illustration here of just how tiny of a fraction of the entire spectrum visible light is. So I have a deck of cards here. And we're going to imagine that the Jack of Clubs, doesn't matter, the thickness of this card represents the slice of the electromagnetic spectrum which is visible to our eyes and therefore essential for this process of photosynthesis which gives us our oxygen and our glucose in order to live and have energy. So if we imagine then the entire electromagnetic spectrum from the tiniest gamma waves to the largest of radio waves, somewhere in there is this slice which represents the visible light. How tall do you imagine this deck of cards needs to be to represent that spectrum?
Mile.
Not close. Taller.
4 miles.
This deck of cards would need to stack from here beyond our galaxy. Beyond the galaxy, sorry, I lost where, what's the next galaxy? I have it written. It needs to reach just beyond the Andromeda galaxy. 2.5 light years tall. This stack of cards needs to be, and that is the amount of that spectrum which is visible light to us. It's absolutely unbelievable. It's absolutely unbelievable that this tiny slice of all that spectrum is the only slice that's valuable or useful and actually not devastating, not vaporizingly destructive to us. This is the spectrum which God has given to us as light, which produces all the life that we see and that we experience. It's absolutely incredible. Just on one side of this is the infrared spectrum, which is not actually visible to our eyes, but that is heat radiation, which is also absolutely critical. Now, if you think that is amazing, well, actually, before we get to that part, so everything that is not in this spectrum would either vaporize us or would be so useless and weak that it would have no effect. So from the tiniest gamma waves, as we've mentioned, all the way to radio waves, the gamma waves being fractions of nanometers, so tiny, to radio waves, which may be kilometers in their peak to peak in their waves, the difference is 10 to the 25th power. So that's 10 followed by 25 zeros is the number which represents the overall width of that spectrum. And there's our slice of visible and useful light to us. It's absolutely incredible. Now, as I mentioned, that's only half the story. So imagine this deck of cards now is not cards, but unique individual keys. And our Earth is surrounded by an atmosphere. And the atmosphere of our Earth is like a lock, which blocks out all frequencies apart from that one. It's absolutely incredible. So not only is there a frequency of light, which is, or a frequency of this, or a slice of this spectrum, which is useful for us, our atmosphere is perfectly in tune with that to allow only this through and block everything else out. If you think about that, the chances of picking two identical cards in two stacks that are 2.5 light years tall is just, I don't even have words. It's just, it's absolutely unfathomable that our atmosphere is so perfectly suited to the light that we need in order to just exist, in order for life to exist on this planet. So this is perhaps, as one podcast I was reading, this is perhaps the most extraordinary coincidence in all of nature that we have this phenomenon. It's just absolutely astonishing. But wait, there's more. Our sun, the sun that we have in our solar system, almost 50% of its total output of radiation, almost 50% is in this tiny, tiny range. So we could have the perfect conditions for light to support photosynthesis and growth. That's fine. But we have an atmosphere which is wrong, and it's a non-starter. We could have this range of light which produces photosynthesis and an atmosphere which allows for this light to come in, and our sun could be wrong. And so it isn't. It all works together, and it's just, it is so, so remarkable the fact that we can even just be standing here with energy to move and talk and think and live and exist. That's just absolutely amazing. It's absolutely astonishing. So our sun produces this very, very specific, there's not enough varies there, this very specific range of electromagnetic radiation, which is perfect for us, and it produces infrared rays, which heat and warm the planet, and our atmosphere is so perfectly suited to this, it's like a blanket, which doesn't bake and cook our planet, but keeps the Earth warm enough. Otherwise, when every time a cloud would go over, we would freeze, and every time a cloud would go away, we would burn. But we don't, because our atmosphere is so perfectly suited as this blanket that absorbs just the right amount of this radiation to keep us alive and to exist. And so this impossibly unlikely phenomenon allows for plenty of oxygen. A planet which is, our atmosphere is up to 20% oxygen, which is actually critical for organisms like ours, which are relatively large in size. And we're not, you know, tiny bacteria or crickets or something like that. Creatures with our size that God has created, need at least, I think, we would not survive with any less than 10% oxygen in order for us to have the energy which we need to exist. Our atmosphere has around 21% oxygen, which is just astonishing that all these phenomena exist simultaneously. It's just one of the myriad of reasons which make Earth so unique, the only planet in the universe capable of sustaining life. It's just absolutely staggering, this level of complexity. And it gives tremendous weight to the words in Genesis chapter 2, verse 7. The Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living creature. And so when we breathe in this oxygen, that's what we can think of. And Job says in chapter 33, verse 4, the Spirit of God has made me, and the breath of the Almighty gives me life. So the next time you brush your teeth, or you play catch, or you type on a keyboard, or wave goodbye, or turn the pages to find hymn 44 in your hymn book at the close of our time tonight, just remember the absolute impossibility of all of this without the guidance and without the wisdom of a loving creator. And we can echo the words of King David in Psalm 139 and verse 14. He says, I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made.